Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
See what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I'm having the same. Go see what the boys in the back room will have, and give them the poison they name.
Today I'm proud to be in the publishing house Orion on the launch day of Girls Will Be Girls, dressing up, playing parts and daring to act differently with Emma O'Toole. Hi Emma, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi Josephine, thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure. So having studied philosophy and theatre and with your interest in feminism, you've mixed up the three into performance art, which questions gender identity.
Absolutely. I can't take credit for the idea. The idea is really Judith Butler's, and in the late 80s, she started thinking about and writing about gender identity as a kind of a performance. So she wasn't saying straightforwardly that, you know, to be a woman or a man is just performance, but what she was saying is that there is, that it is what she calls performative, or that we perform our identities into being over time by repeating certain acts that we learn from our society, by dressing in ways that we know are appropriate for our sex, and we learn all of these codes from our home lives, our school lives and wider culture. So I took this idea that Judith Butler outlines. So I wanted to make it accessible. I wanted to make it fun. I wanted to explain it the way that I explain it to my friends in the pub, not in a kind of a teacherly fashion. So I had lots of fun writing the book, and I hope it provides a lot of food for thought.
Well, it certainly does. So let's start at the beginning of the book. You went to a Halloween disco in your town, Galway, dressed as a boy.
Yes, boys are very scary, so I think it's a good thing to be for Halloween. No, I jest. I decided to cross-dress for Halloween one year, which was a huge departure from my usual kind of sex kitten Halloween costumes. One year I decided I would be a boy for Halloween. And I just put together a really kind of lo-fi costume, which involved borrowing my brother's baggy trousers and stuffing some newspaper into the toes of my brother's trainers, and putting on a baggy t-shirt, strapping my boobs down, putting on a beanie hat, and just drawing some shadow on my face with some pencil. It was really very simple. But what was amazing was how easily everyone was fooled by these really simple, shallow markers of gender. I had friends who I'd known for my whole life fail to recognise me in this really, you know, not particularly bamboozling costume. You know, and I would have been a 5'5" boy weighing about 9 stone, you know, but still it fooled so many people. And it made me see that really, when it comes to gender, we look at very shallow markers and we make huge judgments based on those. And from there, really, I started playing with gender in lots of other ways.
No, definitely. So you mentioned an incident in a pub where you kind of were a sexist then.
Well, I'm still sexist. We're all sexist. We're all a bit sexist. We're all a bit racist. We're all a bit homophobic. We're all a bit transphobic. We're all a bit ableist. And this is because we grow up in a society that has all of these prejudices. And these prejudices are embedded in our psychologies at the most fundamental cognitive level. Even those of us who've done a lot of working through all these prejudices, there are still going to be times when we have thought patterns that reveal them. But even before I had this knowledge that I was a little bit racist, a little bit sexist, a little bit homophobic, etc., I was just, you know, regular old sexist. I understood myself to be the equal of men. I understood myself to have never experienced any discrimination. And instead of being able to see a wider structure that oppressed women, I kind of bought the capitalist logic, I suppose, that if you work hard and you make the right choices, you can succeed if you try. And so when people tried to tell me that feminism was necessary, I would say things like, that's ridiculous, you know, this isn't the 50s, sexism doesn't exist anymore. And so I start the book there because I don't want to put myself in some kind of ivory tower looking down. I want it to be very apparent that, like, I've had to break down all of these thought patterns and prejudices. You know, I didn't come from some lefty liberal utopia with my parents giving me Simone de Beauvoir for my 15th birthday. It was kind of the scales of patriarchy slowly falling from my eyes. And I tried to kind of recreate that narrative in the book. And I hope I do so in a way that, while it's critical of my 19-year-old sexist self, I hope it also shows a bit of love for her, because she did the best with what she had. She believed that men and women were equal. She just hadn't been given the tools to see the inequality.
So you're unprejudiced against your old self.
I wouldn't want to hang out with her, but I think she's a lovely girl.
RadioGorgeous.com. Tell us about the pressure we have with our looks and being a woman. You said in the book that you used to kind of really be dieting all the time. You plucked yourself silly and you worried about going out without makeup.
Absolutely. I went on my first diet when I was 12 with my cousin, and I am by no means an early rider on the bad body image bandwagon. Ofsted shows that by the age of 10, about half of young girls are worrying about their weight and their looks. So I went on my first diet when I was about 12. By the time I was 15, I was restricting what I ate hugely. And by the time I was 16, I was anorexic. I spent a lot of time, as did my friends, thinking about makeup and clothes and the kind of clothes to wear to make boys like me or to be fashionable. And while there's nothing wrong with having an interest in fashion or in beauty, I feel like this was a kind of destructive and kind of consuming obsession with physical appearances above and beyond what's really important about women. By the time I was in my early 20s, I felt like I couldn't leave the house without makeup. And, you know, I still know so many of my friends who are in the same boat. I mean, take last year's no makeup selfie craze, which I think was great. Like, I think it was really wonderful that, like, women were being brave and saying, I usually do this, but I'm not going to do it on social media. Here's what I look like. And for such a good cause. But I equally think it's kind of sad that we've reached a point in our society where it's considered brave for a woman to just go out in public with no makeup on. I mean, what is happening? Like, these things should make us feel a little bit better, a little like we're having a bit of fun if we do them. We shouldn't feel like we're somehow subnormal and disgusting and ugly if we don't do them. Surely that's counterproductive. That's not a beauty regime at all. That's kind of a regime of shame and of hiding your physicality. So it's been a slow process of breaking down all of that gendered conditioning. I still love playing with makeup. I still love playing dress up. I did an event in Concordia, my university, last week where I wore a tuxedo dress and high stilettos and bare 100% natural hairy legs. So I pioneered hairy legs and stilettos. So I still love all of these things, but I try to subvert them, and I want to feel like I do these things because they're a choice. I want to feel like they make me a little bit happy if I do. I don't want to walk around thinking that I live in a flawed, ugly body and that no one should see it before I modify it. I think that's unhealthy. I think that's so obviously unhealthy, and it scares me a little bit that we've reached a point in our society where that is the default position for so many women, myself included, for a very long time.
I'm really interested in the word choice, because I think that's kind of really the most important word in the book, isn't it?
That is very perceptive and insightful of you, Josephine. Yes, I think choice is one of the key concepts underlying the book. So we talked about the performativity of gender already, how we perform certain gendered behaviours. But there's also, of course, an element of choice. But the problem with this, with the fact that on the one hand we live in a structure that conditions our choices, and on the other hand we're individuals with agency, the problem is that a lot of the time people will ignore the structure, they'll ignore all these forces that shape our choices, and they'll explain everything in terms of choice. My go-to example is often shaving your legs. So if you ask a lot of women, why do you shave your legs? They'll say, I choose to shave my legs. I like the feel of it. I think it looks better. And then if you say, okay, could you imagine not shaving your legs for a summer and dressing the same way you always dress, perhaps in little summer dresses or shorts? Can you imagine what that other side of the choice would look like? And we all know as women that that would be horrendously embarrassing. And I know this because I spent 2 summers doing it and being horrendously embarrassed before I finally got over the shame. And my point is that if you think you're making a choice, but if the opposite of that choice is a huge amount of social embarrassment and shame, then it's not really a choice, is it? It's a coerced choice. And I suppose I'm skeptical of the idea of gendered choices within this coercive system that will shame us if we don't make the right choices for our sex, if we don't do our gender correctly.
Radio Gorgeous. Listen anywhere, anytime. Who do you think are the people who are making us think this way?
There isn't a simple answer to this question. I think certainly capitalism has a role to play. I think certainly a beauty industry that is pushing increasingly invasive, increasingly violent modes of self-improvement, that's in inverted commas, that improvement, like plastic surgery, like increasingly extreme juice diets and detoxes, and of course like Brazilian waxing and Hollywood's, all of these incredibly painful and not, you know, quite unhealthy practices. I certainly think that an industry that is pushing those things to make money is in part to blame. That if there's money to be made from imbuing women with insecurities, that's exactly what capitalism will do. So that's certainly a part of it. There's also the fact that, you know, women in this society are prized based on their beauty and have been for many centuries, whereas men tend to be valued more on their talents. And obviously, this is
their,
a sexist...
Yeah, their power.
Yeah, their power, their money, their abilities, their talents. Whereas women tend to be valued based on their looks. And obviously, this is incredibly sexist and it makes women, you know, ornaments instead of complete human beings. And it's part of the dehumanization of women. From the time we're little girls, part of the way that our mothers and, you know, the older women in our lives show us love is by beautifying us and by, like, you know, putting perfume on us and, you know, giving us a little bit of lipstick. And it's, you know, we begin to associate this obsession with our appearance with love. I certainly find, and I hope my mum won't mind that I mention this, but when I started, you know, rejecting these kind of prevalent beauty norms and trying to carve out a way of being beautiful that felt more healthy, she was quite upset because she liked having a pretty daughter, you know, she liked taking me places and like that I'd be nicely turned out and that she'd feel pride. And so when I turned up to a wedding with like a shaved head and hairy armpits and a girl for a date, my mum was, as I'm sure lots of mums are feeling right now, she was mortified that I had, you know, turned up in this way to a family wedding and like bamboozled that I didn't seem to care that, you know, everyone was pointing at my hairy armpits and hairy legs and shaved head. So it's not just capitalism. It's also like the values of femininity that are embedded in our psyches, in the psyches of our families, of our friends. And that what I tried to paint in my book as well is like how painful it can be to step away from them, because in many ways people feel like you're critiquing them. Like when I stopped shaving my legs, a lot of women's reaction was, oh, are you judging me for shaving mine? And I was like, no, of course I'm not judging you for shaving yours. I'm just interrogating these choices. But I suppose implicit in behaving differently, there is a critique of the norm. Yeah, I think that's another reason we continue to act in these ways, because it makes everyone more comfortable.
Yes, because, you know, it's always, you look lovely. Oh, you look so pretty. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, it's all about that ever since you've been born. I mean, I remember my mum, it was a massive pressure for me to wear makeup. Mm-hmm. And I went through my early 20s just wearing red lipstick. And that was just like the biggest rebellion for me. And I never shaved my legs.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, they're blonde. Why do I need to? Sorry, I mean, it does help that they don't show much.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But all the same, I know lots of women with fair hair on their legs who, in spite of the fact that like it's not very visible, that they still feel this shame. And there was a reality TV star was on Twitter the other day and she'd taken a picture of herself on the beach and she had these tiny little like fair hairs on her thighs, and all of these women started commenting and saying, that's disgusting, you should have shaved your legs. I was like, people shave their thighs now? Like,
well,
that's
I think what's really weird is that people think, because I went and had a Brazilian done because I'd never had one. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd do it for Radio Gorgeous to see what happened. Mm-hmm. And I kept asking the woman who did it, and I kept saying, why do people have it? And she said, they think it's cleanliness. Mm-hmm. Apparently hair now symbolises dirt, which I find really strange, because I'm 50 and pubes were in when I was young. You know, people used to do them heart-shaped and put little ribbons in them in the 70s. And all my boyfriend, when he had sex with me after I've had it done, he said, I don't like it. It's like doing it with a little girl. So it is very strange.
And was it painful for you?
Yes, oh, especially your bum, the back.
Yeah. I had one done, like you did for Radio Gorgeous. I had a Brazilian done as research for the book. And I could not believe how painful it was. And I don't know if I just have particularly coarse hair. I just could not believe how painful it was. And what's your name, Dakota? What's your name from 50 Shades of Grey?
Yeah.
She said that the most painful part of that movie was getting the Hollywood, the fanny waxing.
That's much worse than the whipping. And
right? It's so... Like, I have tattoos. I play knuckles with my brothers when I'm drunk at parties. Like, I'm not a wimp. This was the sorest... Like, this was the most painful procedure I've been through. Sorer than, like, certain surgeries. Certainly sorer than having a tattoo. I could not believe how painful it was.
Radio Gorgeous. Podcasts for women. Now, it has been brought on by pornography on the internet, I really think.
I think that at the moment we have a lot of very bad porn. And I don't think that the answer to bad porn is no porn. I think that the answer to bad porn is good porn. And by good porn, I don't mean it's
a pretty setting.
Yeah, a pretty setting, or like woman on top and man in gimp mask, or like, you know, we will skew the gender. But I mean that it is made by women, that women have an equal role in the script writing process and the directorial process, that the workers in that industry are treated with fairness and dignity. And when that happens, I feel like it's not up to me to judge what's put out. But I also think that when that happens, you will see, with increased female control of the means of production in that industry, you'll see varieties of pornography that are not so misogynistic. Because, you know, you click on Pornhub or whatever, and it is misogyny in action. And, you know, it is these cartoonish bodies with fake breasts, completely shaved. A lot of them look... For to my eyes, at least, to be malnourished, and a lot of them appear to be like quite young. And, you know, there's obviously such potential for harm there and for exploitation of the weak. I'm not anti-porn. I'm pro erotic material, and I'm pro like satisfying sex lives for women. But certainly porn today is majorly problematic. The industry is controlled by men. The money goes to men. It's another exploitation of women's bodies. And of course it shapes young men's desires and their expectations. We know that from the work of numerous psychologists. But like I said, I don't think the answer is no porn. I think the answer is better porn.
Do you know any women who are making porn? Have you found any?
Yeah, Anna Spann makes porn. I don't love her stuff because she keeps letting the guys keep their socks on. And I just think...
That's not sexy.
Really? Like, just take the socks off, please.
No. That's too real.
Yeah. What's under there? Do you have an ingrown toenail? I am not aroused.
I think socks on are eternal.
Catherine Briard, the French erotic filmmaker, does some really interesting stuff. Has some problematic politics, particularly in regards to gay men, but it's bloody sexy, and certainly a lot less politically problematic than the standard fare. Yeah, there's lots of erotic material by women out there, but the thing is you have to pay for it because the money won't be given to women for big projects. So you need to pay for it. So basically, pay for porn for feminism.
Yeah, sounds brilliant. Now let's go back to when you were growing up. Mm-hmm. Your mum was a working mother. Mm-hmm. She did all the housework. Mm-hmm. Did you have a dad around?
I do have a dad, and my parents were together when I was younger. But he was of a generation of Irish males where their mothers and the women in their lives had conditioned them to believe that if they tried to hang out the washing, they would strangle themselves and die, so they didn't try. My father didn't cook and doesn't cook. And, you know, I remember being 15 and him asking, could you explain to me my mum had gone somewhere, how to make rice? And I was like, you make rice by following the instructions on the back of the rice packet. And then he like somehow managed to follow the instructions and burn the rice. I don't know. So he just, you know, he had never been brought up to believe that it was his job to cook. He was going to go out and he was going to earn the money. And, you know, he was going to have a wife who would also have a career, hopefully, because, you know, he was quite progressive.
Your mum did or does have a career.
Yeah.
She works in sexual health.
Yeah, my mum ended up being quite successful. My mum went away nursing. When my mum was a teenager, when she'd finished school, she really would have had three options. She could have become a nun, got married, or gone nursing to England. So she picked the third option and she went to England and she trained as a nurse. You know, this would have been a time where nuns trained you as nurses and all the doctors were male and all the nurses were female. We see a lot more blending of those roles now, but at the time, an incredibly gender segregated industry. She came back to Galway in her 20s and she, having lived in London for a while and imbibed some progressive ideas. This was the late 70s, early 80s in Ireland. Remember that contraception was illegal. a short time after my mum came back to Ireland, the government legalised contraception with huge outcry from the Catholic Church, but only with a prescription. So if you wanted to buy condoms in Ireland in the early 80s, you needed to have a prescription for a doctor. So a group of people set up the Galway Family Planning Clinic. The west of Ireland is the most conservative part of Ireland for historical reasons. And they decided that there would just be a doctor there all day, every day, writing prescriptions. So if you wanted condoms, here was a condom shop, basically. And she has lots of funny stories about, like, the Legion of Mary traipsing up and down, holding a huge statue of the Virgin, traipsing up and down in front of the street, you know, reciting Hail Marys to try to prevent people from going in to buy these sinful devices. So my mum was involved with this endeavour from early days, and my mum would never call herself a feminist. In fact, she gets a bit annoyed with me for, like, being a feminist, but her entire life has been dedicated to, you know, ensuring greater reproductive rights for the women of the west of Ireland, and that is huge.
But she sounds like the greatest inspiration.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She's such an inspiration.
So Girls Will Be Girls is published by Orion, and it's by Emer O'Toole, available now.
And when I die, don't pay the preacher for speaking of my glory and my fame. See what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them my size.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com, produced and presented by Josephine Pembroke, and beautifully edited by Ella Gray Thomas, 2015.